Earlier this week, the Food and Drug Administration proposed a rule change that would require the makers of antibacterial soaps, body washes, and other household items to prove that their products are safer and better than plain old soap and water. This comes after numerous studies have pointed to potential health risks in humans from the active ingredients in many antibacterial products. Joining us now is Ralph Halden, director of the Center for Environmental Security at Arizona State University. He also serves as an advisor to the FDA. Welcome to our show.
Thank you.
The two chemicals in question are trichlorocarbon and triclosan. What gives them these chemicals antibacterial qualities?
Yeah, that's a very good question to launch. So these chemicals were made back in the 1950s and 1960s, and so they come from the heydays of chlorine chemistry, where we discovered that we can take ordinary chemicals like a benzene ring and hang some chlorines on them and make them and give them very new and interesting properties. And so a lot of these chemicals went into large production at the time, and then we discovered problems with them later on. And so triclosan and trichlorocarbon belong to these types of chlorinated aromatic compounds. And, you know, other ones that people might be more familiar with are, for example, DDT or polychlorinated biphenyls and dioxins and similar things.
Although they've all been banned already, haven't they?
Yeah. So it's really these, in a way, these are a little bit of a leftover of chemicals that have not been addressed appropriately.
Well, these are not antibiotics in the way that penicillin is an antibiotic.
No, that's true. These chemicals initially were labeled as being having not a singular mechanism, but being kind of broadband disruptors of microbial life. It turned out then later on that triclosan actually had a specific point of mode of action, and that related then to a potential cross resistance with other bacteria.
Is there any
other antibiotics?
So, is there any evidence that you've seen that indicates that antibacterial soaps and body washes containing trichlorocarbon or triclosan are any more effective than plain soap and water?
Well, there's a large body of studies that is available in literature. And as always, there are some studies showing that these chemicals are effective, and then there's a vast amount of literature also showing that they're not effective. I think they are labeled antimicrobials because they can kill microorganisms, and they will do so if you use them in the right fashion. So, for example, in a clinical setting or in a hospital or in an operating room, people will wash their hands, the surgeons, for, you know, several minutes and scrub and so forth. And that allows these chemicals to be effective. But if you stand and observe how people wash their hands, if they wash them at all, in public restrooms, you see that the contact time there is probably on the order of, you know, 10 seconds, 20 seconds max. And it turns out that under these short contact times, the chemicals can't really have any beneficial effect. And that has later on then been shown in larger studies where people, for example, studied students or populations in public places and demonstrated that it really makes no difference whether the people use the antimicrobial soap or regular soap. The main thing is to wash your hands frequently.
Well, how did these chemicals come to be added to a wide range of consumer products? Was there consumer demand?
Well, yes and no. I mean, I think the industry always thrives to distinguish their products from others. So if you can put a claim on that your product is better, then you are in a better place. And so I think there was a natural incentive to add something that would be more effective in killing bacteria. But it turns out that, again, that the science isn't behind this. And we saw then but what we've recently seen is a proliferation of these antimicrobial products. And so what really has happened is that there is a marketing is very aggressive, and oftentimes the use of these products is linked to being safer from the infections that are being reported on in the media.
Well, were there these chemicals studied for potential health risks before they were added to soaps and body washes?
That's a good question. So what the FDA did right now is they tried to bring in an amendment to the what's called the tentative final monograph, and that was launched in 1974. And it's called tentative because it was never finalized, it was never released. And next year, 2014, marks the 40th anniversary of not having finalized this tentative final monograph.
Are they aware of the fact that they haven't finalized it?
Yeah, the file has not been lost. So actually, I sat on a panel in 2005 where they tried to finalize it, but then and had expert opinions on this delivered, and also heard from the industry. But it's very difficult because this monograph, so this is essentially a regulation that looks at a lot of different chemicals. It's very broad and it can't do justice for every single chemical. And that relates back to the introduction that was made where the industry now has to show that the chemicals are safe. So back in 1974, there already was evidence that triclosan, for example, was maybe not safe and also maybe not effective. So there were lingering doubts about that. Now, 40 years forward, we now know that the chemical is not effective for hand washing, which is the major use of triclosan in soaps. And that it also promotes antimicrobial drug resistance, which is a very dangerous game to play because the antibiotics that we have right now are our last resort from preventing potentially lethal infections. And so we can't put at risk the efficacy of our antibiotics. And triclosan and triclocarbon are chemicals that can do so and do so.
They also can have an impact on hormones, which I assume means that different people would have different reactions to them.
Right. So maybe going back to the comment that I made that this is, the old-fashioned chlorine chemistry from which we really want to get away these days. So these chemicals are cannot be handled by normal enzymes. They don't degrade very quickly, and that gives them very long environmental half-lives. So we can't degrade them in our body. The wastewater treatment plants can't degrade it. Whenever a chemical, doesn't have a removal mechanism, then it is free to roam and find places where it can interfere, and oftentimes it does so. And so triclosan and triclocarbon, they interfere with the human body by binding or mediating the binding of hormones to the receptors. And that probably doesn't mean much for people who are not trained in biology, so maybe I can use an analogy. If you have a good phone connection, then you get the message in the conversation. But if you have a lot of static and if there's noise in the conversation, then you might get the wrong message. And so it takes just a lack of a word or one word too much that you hear, and it completely changes the message. And the same is true with in endocrine disruptors. The chemicals that interfere with hormone messaging in the human body.
And isn't there evidence that they can have an impact on puberty and fertility and perhaps our metabolisms as well?
Yeah, I think the strongest link is to metabolism because it has been shown that triclosan binds to the thyroid hormone receptor and emulates the thyroid hormone. And so that means if you have a chemical that interferes with metabolism, that means that your metabolism can be accelerated or slowed down. So you might gain weight or you lose weight. It affects your behavior, and actually we have a lot of phenomena in society, attention deficit disorder and so forth, behavioral aspects that are unexplained right now. We're still looking for the causes. And chemicals that are functioning as endocrine disruptors are kind of on the top of the hit list of things to look at.
And yet they have been put into mouthwashes, detergents, even baby pacifiers. That's scary.
That's true, but it turns out that the concerns that have been raised about these chemicals haven't really been communicated very effectively to the consumers. I think the consumers got only the one side information by there's dangerous infections out there and microorganisms, and we have to protect ourselves by buying antimicrobial products. And what we've done is we created a cold war with the microorganisms by ratcheting up our arsenal of antimicrobials, and the microorganisms in return now begin to become resistant to not only the antimicrobials that we use, but also the antibiotics. And that's a dangerous game to play, and we can't really afford that.
Do we know whether there are safe dosages?
Well, actually, for chemicals that interfere with cell messaging and signaling, there really is no, you know, safe level, because if you add molecules to it and they have an effect, they automatically modulate your message. Clearly, sometimes these chemicals are not very effective in mimicking hormones, and so you need larger concentrations. But they do have an effect, and it was demonstrated that the levels that can be reached in human blood after, for example, showering with antimicrobial soap are in the range at which we see effects in animals.
Ralf Halden is director of the Center for Environmental Studies at Arizona State University. What happens to these chemicals when we wash our hands and then it goes down the drain? Do they remain in the environment? You took sediment core samples in Jamaica Bay here in New York, didn't you?
That's right.
What did you find?
So let me give you a quick tour of what happens to the stuff that we flush away and never want to see again. It's actually quite interesting. So we flush the toilet, we rinse our hands off, and the water goes through a sewer system, arrives ideally at a wastewater treatment plant. And the wastewater treatment plant is nothing but like a great microbial zoo that takes the best of aerobic and anaerobic microorganisms to degrade all the stuff that's coming in. And some things are physically removed, but we rely heavily on microorganisms. Now, the microorganisms that encounter the antimicrobials that you just flushed down the drain, they can't deal with that stuff. So rather than degrading it, it becomes part of the municipal sludge that is being produced, or it exits the tailpipe of the wastewater treatment plant. Now, before we had the safe, the Clean Water Act, we discharged primary treated water, wastewater, into the coastal waters. And that also happened in Jamaica Bay. And so we went out there and did sampling in Chesapeake Bay and also analyzed samples from Jamaica Bay. And we found the, in the cores, when you put a core, a plexiglass rod or sleeve into the sediment, that is the muck underneath the water, you can actually pull out a black layer of the sediment. And each layer corresponds to a time period. And as you go down, you can go back in time and find the layer that was deposited, you know, way back when. And so we analyzed these layers and found that we did not see triclosan and triclocarban before the 1950s because they weren't produced then. So triclocarban was patented in 1957 and triclosan in 1964. And, you know, immediately after patenting of these chemicals, we see their deposition profile in the sediments in off the coast of New York City. So that's really fascinating. These chemicals do not degrade, and they are still awaiting, you know, degradation now 40, 50 years after they have been deposited there.
Do we know if triclosan and triclocarban are being absorbed by fish and shellfish, the oysters that are being replanted in Jamaica Bay?
That's right. So also when you add chlorines to this normal carbon chemistry, then the chemicals don't like water as much anymore as they did before. And that means they, at any expense, they want to get out of the water and get into something else. Turns out that we and other biota are great things to get into if you don't like water, because we harbor a lot of fat and the chemicals feel better. They are just better off being in fat. And so what happens is that the organisms, including humans, accumulate these chemicals in body fat. And that can be detected then. That's one of the reasons why we can detect triclosan in 97% of breast milk samples from U.S. women.
Wow. But there doesn't seem to be much public awareness about this. I don't hear of many activists trying to get things changed. Although last week we did a segment on our show about some of the shocking conditions in factory farms, and one of the issues we discussed was the public's reluctance to want to know where their food comes from and what's in their food. Is there a similar issue with chemicals in common household products?
Yeah, definitely. There's the awareness just isn't there. The interest isn't there. And a lot of people also, they shrug their shoulders when they say, oh, all these antimicrobials are accumulating in the environment. But, if you look from an ecological perspective, there's organisms that have never seen an environment that is not loaded with antimicrobials. You know, the benthic organisms that live in the bay, in Jamaica Bay, Chesapeake Bay, they are encountering antimicrobials at extremely high levels. And so that fosters just the development of antibiotic resistance. And also, also creates an environment that is just not very suitable for life. And the tragic thing is that the chemicals are called antimicrobials, but it turns out that they are much more toxic to aquatic organisms, and so they very effectively kill algae and crustaceans, which are little, you know, little organisms living in the muck. And so they are very effective in killing those and not quite as effective in killing microorganisms.
So are they creating superbacteria in Jamaica Bay?
It is. Whenever you have bacteria together with antimicrobials, you create essentially a breeding ground for antimicrobial resistance. And that is happening on a massive scale in all the environments where we have disposed of these antimicrobial-laden wastes. And so the sediments of our freshwater environments, the coastal zones, are contaminated with the antimicrobials. And then we also have municipal sludge that is produced as a byproduct in wastewater treatment. And 50% of that is applied on agricultural land. So then the triclosan and triclocarbon get exported. Now, after the Clean Water Act has been instituted, since the 1970s, we are now depositing these chemicals on land. And it's also on agricultural land, so there's a potential link back into the food chain.
Has there been much pushback from the antibacterial soap industry to the new FDA rules?
Yeah, I think they have been fighting it all along, and maybe they are also responsible for delaying this decision, which, you know, it's a difficult one again. But I think it's very, very clear-cut for triclosan and triclocarbon. We are looking here at two chemicals that are ineffective, and then we're looking at broad-scale exposure of the general population to these chemicals. We do know that they're endocrine disrupting, that they're bioaccumulative, and that they're persistent. So from my, you know, from a public health perspective, if we cannot regulate these chemicals, then good luck making progress on other fronts. These are, you know, and since they're left over from, you know, from yesterday's chemistry, we really need to move on and find better alternatives to that. And actually, for hand washing, we don't need antimicrobials for the most part. The surgeons need it, yes. Should they use triclosan, triclocarbon? Certainly. But not every person on the street. We don't give antibiotics to everybody on the street either, right? So there's applications where we need these chemicals, and then there's just overuse, which can then result in dangerous consequences.
And yet the New York Times notes in their reporting on this that the FDA's rule doesn't apply to hand sanitizers. They're being considered separately. Do we know why?
So hand sanitizers oftentimes don't contain triclosan or triclocarbon. They are typically containing alcohols. And these are non-chlorinated chemicals. We understand those fairly well. So there's not a concern about these alcohol-containing chemical formulations. But I have to say that, you know, for people who buy these products, it's good to practice good hygiene. But whenever you are in the proximity of a faucet and some soap, use that. Because if we apply ethanol and other alcohols to our skin, the skin becomes dry and brittle. And that, you know, creates pathways for microorganisms to venture into your body and then cause infections.
So alcohol is not the answer either. In any way, we're not so sure we want to put alcohol in our mouthwash or in baby pacifiers.
Yeah, well, it's, you know, it's a good idea to have these products. If you change a diaper, you know, and you have these alcohol based products around, that's great to use. But you know, look for the next faucet and wash your hands with regular soap and water, and that's much safer.
Ralph Halden serves as an advisor to the FDA. He is director of the Center for Environmental Security at Arizona State University. And we've been talking about the use of triclocarbon and triclosan in all sorts of things that you'll find around the house, and why the FDA is finally banning them. Thank you so much for being on our show.
My pleasure.